A t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors. The difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Learn why at Schwabvious.com.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're doing a rapid-fire look at some high-stakes political conflict, some really unexpected electoral shifts, and, well, the explosive results of mandated transparency.
That's right.
If you need a shortcut to understand the three big fault lines just ripping through the political world this week, this is your deep dive.
Absolutely. What we're doing here is analyzing how this one single issue, the huge push to get the Jeffrey Epstein files released, is basically acting as a political stress test.
A stress test. I like that.
Yeah. And it's changing the power dynamics for, you know, both parties at the same time.
And what the sources are showing us isn't just what's in the files, but the crazy, often contradictory political scrambling to survive this whole push for transparency. So let's start with the vote. Tomorrow's vote on H.R. 4405, the Epstein Files Transparency Act.
Right. The whole point of the act is to force the Department of Justice to release everything, all the files. And the reason this is even happening, against the wishes of some of the GOP leadership, is because of something called a discharge petition.
Okay, so for anyone who doesn't live and breathe congressional procedure, let's break that down. Why is a discharge petition such a big deal here?
Think of it as a kind of procedural revolt. Normally, the speaker, you know, he decides what bills come to the floor for a vote.
He controls the agenda.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But a discharge petition, if you get 218 signatures, it lets you go around the speaker, go around the committees, and just force a vote on the floor. It's a direct challenge.
And while they only needed 218 to force it, the vote itself is expected to be a landslide.
Oh, huge. Probably 250, maybe even 300 votes.
Which creates, a complete catastrophe for someone like Speaker Mike Johnson. He's really caught between a rock and a hard place.
It's an impossible spot. It really is. If a Republican votes for releasing the files, they risk getting a primary challenger backed by Donald Trump. It's seen as disloyalty.
But if they vote against it,
then the Democrats get this. This perfect, devastating campaign slogan. Congressman so-and-so tried to protect pedophiles.
You can't recover from that.
You can't. The only safety, as our sources point out, is in numbers. If a whole bunch of them vote yes, it's harder for Trump to go after any single one of them.
So what about the Senate? John Thune faces the same political backlash, but he has a bit of an advantage, institutionally speaking.
He does, because the Senate doesn't have a discharge procedure. So he can just refuse to hold a vote.
Wow.
Yeah, he can just sit on it. Shield Trump, shield the party. Unless, of course, the public outcry gets so loud, he starts to worry about Democrats taking the Senate in 2026.
But then, just when you think you know how this will play out, everything changed. Late Sunday night, Trump did a complete 180.
It was a shocking U-turn. He went from fighting this to suddenly telling all Republicans to vote for releasing the files.
And calling it a Democrat hoax.
Right, saying we have nothing to hide.
That feels like a very defensive move. If you know the bill's going to pass with, 300 votes, why not try to get in front of it and claim you wanted it all along?
That's exactly the strategy. He saw it's unstoppable. So instead of it looking like this massive rejection of his power, he pivots and tries to spin it like he was leading the charge. But here's the key point.
Yeah.
Now he owns it. He is now politically responsible for whatever comes out. He can't blame the Democrats anymore. He told his party to do it. The fallout is his.
Speaking of fallout, let's talk about what's already leaking from those 23,000 pages given to the House Oversight Committee. Some of these little nuggets are pretty revealing.
They really are. And they hit people all over the map, which confirms this is less about one party and more about, you know, elite power. First up is Michael Wolff.
Right.
There's an email from Epstein back in 2019. It apparently says, of course, Trump knew about the girls.
Yeah.
And it seems Wolff had offered to help Epstein manage that.
That is incredibly specific. But it's not just Trump. The net is way wider. We've got former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers in there.
Yep. The documents say Summers mentioned that Saudi officials saw Trump as a dangerous clown. And, maybe more damaging, there are these derogatory comments he apparently made about women in science, linking it to IQ distribution.
It's this bizarre window into what powerful people say when they think no one is listening. There's even a comment from Catherine Wimley, who was a White House counselor for Obama.
That one was shocking. It was this really personal, candid admission about having a panic attack after seeing overweight people at a rest stop in New Jersey.
It just paints this picture of a world completely detached from everyday life.
Totally. And we also see Epstein trying to set up a meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, claiming he could explain Trump's whole personality, that Trump always has to be seen as getting something out of any deal.
Okay, one last piece before we move on. The Ghislaine Maxwell situation. The sources detail some very unusual treatment she's getting in her minimum security prison.
Highly unusual. We're talking custom meals, private use of the exercise room.
Visitors are bringing computers into her cell.
Into her cell, allowing who knows what contact with the outside world. And get this, she apparently has access to a puppy.
A puppy? In a federal prison. That screams special treatment. It raises a huge question. What did she tell Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche to get all that?
Whatever it was clearly considered incredibly valuable.
Mm.
And the fight over that kind of information leads us right to our next political fault line. This incredible public war between Donald Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene.
His one staunchest ally. And her push on the Epstein files is what set this all off.
That's the link. This isn't just policy anymore, it's personal. Trump is calling her Wacky Marjorie, a ranting lunatic.
Marjorie Taylor Greene.
And she's hitting right back, directly connecting his anger to her push on the Epstein files. She basically said she never imagined fighting for this would cause such a war, which suggests the reaction itself is, you know, telling.
She claims this is all because Trump has drifted from his America First agenda. Let's run through the five big policy splits the sources lay out.
Okay, first, the obvious one, the Epstein files. Greene was one of only three Republican women to sign that discharge petition. The other two, Lauren Boebert and Nancy Mace, are both survivors of sexual assault or trauma, so for them, this is deeply personal.
Right. Second is health insurance. Greene is hammering the GOP for not having a real alternative to Obamacare, especially with premiums potentially doubling.
Third, affordability. She's basically saying the GOP is headed for a disaster in 2026 if they don't get the cost of living down, and she's attacking Trump for not doing it when he had the chance.
Fourth is H-1B visas. This is a big one. She wants to phase out the whole program, stop all foreign workers. Trump, on the other hand, has called for more skilled immigrants.
And his own company requested, what, a record 184 temporary visas last year?
Exactly. And finally, number five, foreign affairs. Greene wants to cut all funding to Ukraine and Israel. She's a strict isolationist. Trump, meanwhile, is still sending aid to Ukraine and maybe starting a new fight with Venezuela.
So she's not just attacking him personally. She's building a case based on actual policy. It's a strategy.
A strategy for what, though?
Well, she probably knows she can't be president. But what about vice president in 2028? Think about a Vance Greene ticket. By challenging Trump now, she stays relevant, she gets in the news, and she positions herself as the person to get Mangier back on course in the next cycle.
That's a fascinating angle, turning a feud into a long-term political play. Okay, let's shift from future races to the electoral map right now because there's a huge development with the Latino vote.
This is really significant. We're looking at data from recent elections in New Jersey, Union City, Perth Amboy.
Yeah.
In 2024, we all saw that big swing of Latino voters from Biden to Trump.
Everyone was talking about it. A major realignment.
Well, in 2025, those exact same voters swung just as hard back to the Democrats.
So it wasn't a permanent realignment after all.
It doesn't look like it. The strategist Mike Madrid had a great explanation for this. He says it's an anti-incumbent protest vote. In 2024, the party in power nationally was the Democrats, so they voted Republican.
A protest vote.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In 2025, in these local races, the establishment was often Republican, so they protested by voting Democrat. It's this powerful but very volatile anti-establishment feeling.
And adding to those worries for the GOP, there's a YouGov poll showing a total collapse for Trump among independents.
It's brutal. His approval with independents started his term at a net negative 5%. Now, it's net negative 35%. That's way worse than at the same point in his first term.
And when the president's numbers with independents fall off a cliff like that?
It drags everything else down. The generic House ballot, according to the sources, is now at D+7.
D+7. That's a wave election territory. And there's a Democrat who seems to be seizing on this moment, Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego. Let's talk about his profile as a potential 2028 contender.
I mean, he's ticking every single box. He's Latino. He's a decorated Marine combat veteran.
Harvard degree.
A Harvard degree. And from a critical swing state, Arizona, which borders another one, Nevada, he has this really broad appeal.
And his message is already laser focused on those kitchen table issues. He's blaming Republicans for rising health care premiums and cuts to Medicaid.
Yep. His plan 2029 is all about affordable housing and health care. He's speaking directly to that anti-incumbent anxiety we were just talking about.
So while he's gearing up, the Democrats as a party are already testing a strategy for 2026. And it's interesting, they're targeting someone who won't even be on the ballot, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
It's the classic create a boogeyman strategy. RFK Jr. is unpopular enough, especially on things like vaccines, that the plan is to tie every single Republican candidate to his views.
The goal being to reinforce that idea that Republicans care more about tax cuts for the rich than your family's health.
Exactly. They'll cite his past association with, you know, cuts to cancer research,
yeah,
firing CDC staff, all of it.
Okay, finally, we have two quick updates that say a lot about who really has power in Washington. First, the influence of Laura Loomer.
It's kind of amazing. She has no official role at all, yet she's getting White House nominations pulled. The latest was Donald Korb for IRS chief counsel.
A very experienced guy. He'd already cleared the Senate Finance Committee.
Cleared the committee. But Loomer goes after him on social media, and Trump yanks the nomination, just like that. And now you have this huge leadership vacuum at the IRS right when they're trying to implement all these complex new tax laws.
That could have some serious real-world consequences.
For sure. And our last note is on the Fulton County case in Georgia. Fannie Willis is out, and veteran prosecutor Pete Scandalakis is in.
And we should just remind everyone why this state RACO case is so important.
Yes, because it is a state case, the President of the United States has zero pardon power over any of the 19 defendants. Scandalakis has complete and total discretion here. The legal threat is absolute.
So we started this deep dive with this tension between transparency releasing the Epstein files and the extreme political gymnastics to control it. The sources really paint a picture of a party and its leader being forced into a complete reversal just to try and manage the damage.
And this brings us back to the Watergate comparison the sources make. If the cover-up is worse than the crime, and Trump fought this so hard before his sudden flip, you have to ask yourself, how will the public's perception of just the effort to keep these files hidden affect the 2026 and 2028 elections?
Right. Even if the files themselves end up being heavily redacted.
Exactly. The damage might already be done just from the fight itself. The aggression, the denial, and then this, you know, very sudden, very strategic reversal.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of voters, that might be all the evidence they need.
And that's something for you to think about as you watch this all continue to unfold. Thanks for joining the Deep Dive.